I'll be reading from Mark, the 14th chapter, verses 27 through 31. Jesus was speaking to his apostles on this occasion, predicting some things that would happen, and they were doubtful. "You will all fall away," Jesus told them, "for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Peter declaimed, "Even if all fall away, I will not." "I tell you the truth," Jesus answered, "today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times." But Peter insisted emphatically, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And all of the others said the same.
Thank you, Jack. So I've been living here with my family for coming up, tomorrow will be 7 months. And at different times, we all have these days where just nothing seems to go right, where it doesn't matter what we do, nothing really goes our way. And so here's what happened with mine. If you kind of knew us, if you knew me and my family, when we first moved here, we had some housing situation, had a really hard time selling our house in Huntsville where we were coming from. And at the same time, we're trying to pay for living expenses at Airbnbs and get our house in Huntsville sold so we can buy a house here. We didn't have enough money saved up to pay two mortgages, so our savings are just getting sapped. That whole time, my wife and I had booked like 2 years ago this trip out to Cabo for our fifth anniversary. And we called them, said, "Look, this is really bad timing. Money's low. I know we've already paid it, but money's already low. We need to reschedule." They said, "You cannot reschedule. If you do, you lose everything." So we're losing a $2,000 vacation. So we're like, well, we're broke, but we'll be happily broke in Cabo. So we decided to go out there. And the way it all panned out, our house in Huntsville did end up selling. We're able to buy a house here. We live about a mile from here. And we actually closed while we were in Cabo. We signed power of attorney. Somebody came in and signed for us. A bunch of stuff gets moved into our house. Actually, people here broke into my house and moved my stuff in. You guys reverse robbed me. So all this happens. And we get back. So the very first day we get back, Ashley had been sick for the last 3 days in Cabo. Great vacation. So we have virtually no money left in our bank account because we just bought a new house. We have, like, nothing. Our savings account is at zero, and it's just whatever's left in the checking account. We know it's going to build back up, but that's where we were at the time. So I don't know if you guys remember this, and this day actually reminds me of it. There's this random day in, like, mid to late October, and it's kind of like this, where it's been warm all week last week. It's actually warm all week this week, except there's today, this one day where it doesn't make any sense, but it's cold. And in October, it was the exact same thing, except instead of the high being 60, the high was 48 that day. So we move our kids. My mom had come into town to watch our kids when we were in Cabo. And so she stayed in an Airbnb that's also about a mile from here, pretty close. So everything was really easy. Well, the day we get back is the day we go to the Airbnb, move all of our temporary stuff into our new house. Well, after we move our temporary stuff, I get a call from the people who had the Airbnb and said, "Hey, we think your kids might have left an item or two there." And I said, "Yeah, I'm happy to run back and get it." At this point, I didn't realize it at the time. At this point, Ashley is very sick, very dehydrated, and I think 2 days later we would find out that she would be diagnosed with Salmonella and E. coli at the same time. She's okay. She's right there. She lived. But so oh my goodness, we should pray. She's all right. So she's very, very sick, cannot get out of bed, and I'm at the house with my two kids who are going nuts because we've lived in like four places in the last month, and they don't know which house is actually theirs. So I say, "You know what? Hey, Ashley, I'm going to run over to the Airbnb. I'm going to pick up those items. I'll be right back. It's a mile away. It'll take me 3 minutes to do." My son freaks out, and he's like, "I want to go. I want to go. Daddy, I want to go with you. I want to go with you." I said, "Yeah, okay, sure. Let's go. We come out. He's in, I think, a t-shirt and jeans in 45 degree weather. But I'm thinking, you know what? I'll turn on the heater. We go there. We grab it. We come back. He'll be fine. No big deal. So we go. We go over. I go in, grab the items. Thank you very much. Get back in the car. Battery won't start. But I was literally out for 3 minutes, I think, and drove 1 mile. That's all it took for our battery, which had been going well over a year with no maintenance, to die on us. So normally this is where I call my wife and say, hey, can you come over? She can't get out of bed. So I, because of how close the Airbnb was, I actually called Marvin, said, hey, do you have some jumper cables? I just need a jump. I'm going to have to go over to AutoZone and buy a battery with money I don't have, but, you know, I'll figure it out. So could you come over? He was gracious enough to leave the office, come down. And the whole time, my son Gatlin is starting to get really cold because, well, the car won't start, and it's 45 degrees, and so it's getting colder and colder. Finally, we get the car started, and it's at that point that it's really cold and the car won't start after a mile drive that I realize this day's going to be terrible. I don't know what's going to happen, but this day is probably going to be awful. So I drive to AutoZone. And on the one right over here on Bandera, and I'm on my way to AutoZone, and my dad calls me and said, hey, I hear that Ashley's really sick, and, you know, y'all just moved in the house. Are you doing okay? Are y'all doing all right? And I start venting a little bit. Yeah, she's really sick, and our battery just died, and we don't have any money to buy it, but, I mean, I have no choice because this is the only vehicle we can really use right now. So, you know, I'm going to pay $120 for, and I'm going to figure out where that money's going to come from, and we'll be okay. And I'm sitting, and I finally pull into the parking lot of AutoZone while I'm still talking to him, and I hear my son, who at that point had been three for, I think, 2 months, say, Daddy, I need to go TT. And I didn't think anything of it, but again, he had just started to get potty trained, so his ability to wait wasn't the best, is the best way I'll put it. And so I unbuckle and say, okay, Bubby, hey, let me finish talking to Big Daddy, and then we'll go in, and Daddy will let you go TT. I'm on the phone with my dad, I don't even think it was a minute after, but we're right here, Daddy, I TT my pants, Daddy. And I think, yeah, that sounds about right. This is a great day. So I'm going through, and I'm like, all right, Dad, Gatlin just peed his pants. I'm going to have to let you go. So I hang up, and I'm thinking, okay, well, I'll just change them real quick. There actually is a diaper in here. I'll just stick them in that for the time being because I left it in the diaper bag, and this is change of clothes. And then I realized that because I was only going to go a mile and drive for 3 minutes, I didn't think the diaper bag was necessary at the time, so I didn't pack the diaper bag. And so here's my son with pee, and I mean, when he said he had to go, he wasn't kidding. It went all the way down his pants. Now, like, it wasn't one of those, he might have spilled something. No, he definitely peed his pants. So I'm looking, and I'm thinking, okay, his underwear is soaked, his pants are soaked, and I cannot be the dad who lets a urine-soaked pant child walk into AutoZone. I don't want to deal with that judgment. So what do I do? I look, and I find a diaper that fit my one-year-old daughter, Millie. And so Gatlin's butt cheeks are hanging out of it by the time I put him into it. And then I look around, I'm like, there's no other pants here. I don't know what to put him in. And then I find that there's a blanket in the back. So I'm like, well, I guess this is happening because I don't have any other choices. So I take my son's pants off, put him in the diaper, and I wrap him up in the blanket, and I walk into AutoZone. And I cannot tell you how judged I felt in that AutoZone. I felt more judged in that AutoZone than I've ever felt in a church. And they're all looking like, we know what you're doing. And the whole time I'm sitting there thinking, I don't even care right now. This is the worst day ever. So it's one of those things where one thing happens, and then the next, and then the next, and then the next, and it hits a point where you're thinking, I don't know that it matters what I do. It's just going to keep getting worse. And it goes on and on and on. Thankfully, the AutoZone man was nice enough to install the battery for me so that my crying, urine-soaked pants son, I could put him back in. He fixes the battery that I paid for with money I didn't have at the time, and we were able to go home. Now, eventually everything got fixed. Everything, we end up moving in. Ashley, over time, heals. She's okay, but the entire time we're also kind of worried, because there were some things in our life that was still kind of yet to be determined. And it was one of those days where everything just seemed to go wrong over and over and over. If you look back in that passage from Mark 14 that Jack read earlier, Peter's experiencing something because Jesus, who had a very inept ability as a prophet to predict what was going to happen, Jesus just said, you're all going to leave me. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be betrayed. I'm going to be crucified. And Peter had heard this over and over, and Peter realizes it's coming. Peter says, you know what? I'm never going to leave you. And Jesus says, actually, you are. You're going to publicly deny me three different times. You know, sometimes there's nothing that we can do, and here's a difference, though, that I want us to look at. If you look down and starting in verse 32 of that same chapter, Mark 14, you see two differences, two parallels of a story that's taking place. You see Peter's account, and you see Jesus' account, and their response to the things that are going on. Now again, Peter doesn't fully know and understand what's about to happen. Jesus obviously does. But look at what Peter says about, I will never leave you, no matter if everyone goes. Now, I'm going to go through verse 32, and I started to come up with a PowerPoint, and I'm not good enough to be a Prezi guy. Marvin's just leagues ahead of me. But I kept coming up with PowerPoints, and I realized there's no, like, images and things that I'm going to put it all together. So if you would like to follow along, you're going to have a hard time keeping up unless you get your Bible or Bible app out. So we're in Mark 14 right now if you'd like to join. I think there might be some Bibles under the chair if you want to look for that. But this will be a lot easier for you to keep up. Mark 14... Starting in verse 32, I am just going to read what Jesus said. Okay, so if you have red letters in your Bible, it would be a whole lot easier for you to keep up. Okay, starting in verse 32, Jesus says to his disciples, sit here while I go and pray. My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. Verse 36, I have a father. Everything is possible for you. Please take this cup of suffering away from me, yet I want your will to be done, not mine. Simon, are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch with me even 1 hour? Keep watch and pray so that you will not give in to temptation, for the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Verse 41, go ahead and sleep. Have your rest, but know the time has come. The Son of Man is betrayed and in the hands of sinners. Up, let's be going. Look, my betrayer is here. Especially look at verse 48, while he's being arrested and betrayed. Am I some dangerous revolutionary that you come with swords and clubs to arrest me? Why didn't you arrest me in the temple? I was there among you teaching every day, but these things are happening to fulfill what the scriptures say about me. See, here's the difference. Jesus doesn't fight at any point. If you look really closely, Jesus makes no attempt to fight these guards, to call out Judas, to give any type of true, real resistance to what's going on. And yet Peter, if you look, while he's being betrayed, verse 46 and 47, it doesn't name him, but the other gospel accounts do. It says someone pulled out their sword and cut off the ear of the high priest. That was Peter. The other accounts name him. And Peter's saying, look, I'm never going to leave you. And here he is, he's backing it up. And Jesus is the one who says, put your sword away, because I am not someone who's trying to stir up a riot. I'm not a revolutionary. This was meant to happen according to the scriptures. Here's something that's really different and something that we fight for all the time, but oftentimes we're fighting the wrong battle. Okay? And I want you to think about which side of this you might be on in terms of church, in terms of culture, in terms of your family, and in terms of your life. Peter fights to maintain what he has had for the last 3 years. Jesus gives in to the exact same thing because he knows something so much better is on the horizon. I want you to think about which side might you be on when it comes to church culture, when it comes to your life, when it comes to seeing what's going on in the world. Are you seeing these things and knowing, if I allow these things to happen, these things that might cause me some suffering, perhaps it's going to be good for everyone down the road? This is exactly what Jesus is giving into. But giving into things is something that virtually in everyone's DNA, giving into something that we know could potentially cause suffering, it's not possible for so many of us. As soon as we hear discomfort might happen in a culture where comfort is the easiest to attain here and now than ever in human history. It is easier to stay comfortable now than it has ever been in human history. And so we fight that because, well, we can, but oftentimes this allowing suffering to happen and occur for the greater good down the road is actually something that God indeed calls for us to do. I was talking to Ashley, my wife, about what I was preaching about and the parallels between these two stories. And I said, can you think of someone, maybe Old Testament, New Testament, but obviously besides Jesus, someone who dealt with these same types of situations where they were going to something with practically the certainty that things were probably going to get bad. Doing what they were going to do was not going to work out for them. It was not going to bode well for them. And she sat there for maybe 5 seconds, and she says, "Sarah." I said, "Abraham's wife, Sarah? Is that the Sarah you're talking about?" She said, "Yeah." You know, I never thought about this, because when you look at all the, we love reading the little subheads for Scripture. Those aren't actually in Scripture, but we put them there to help us. So every time we read those, it's all about Abraham, right? In the book of Genesis, and you can go ahead and turn to Genesis, starting in verse 12 is where we see the story. At the time, he's Abram. He'll be called Abraham later, but it's the same person. And there's the story of Sarah. And every time I've read through the story, I've never looked at it through the eyes of Sarah. So when she said that, I thought, okay, I think there's some points that you're making that are really good. I want to go back and read this and read through Sarah's story from the time she appears in Genesis 12 all the way to Genesis 22, 23, where she eventually dies and is buried. And every time over and over we read about God told Abraham this, God told Abraham that. But other than Sarah hearing that she was going to have a son at a ripe old age, Sarah just has to follow along with whatever Abraham says. Now, in Genesis 12, when Abram's called, they live amongst a bunch of polytheists, people who believe in multiple gods. So the idea of believing in one God was offensive to all these nations. And so can you imagine what Sarah was dealing with? Here's what I realized. And maybe it's because of the way that I deal with like hurt and struggle and strife. And maybe you're like me, I get really sarcastic. Does anybody get really sarcastic whenever like things aren't going well, because it helps you cope with it? Here's what I realized about Sarah. And I'll kind of paraphrase these stories. But I started reading through this as if I were Sarah, and I realized she might have been the most sarcastic person of all time. And here's how I arrived at this, okay? Genesis 12, God calls Abram, go into the land that I will show you, I'll make you into a great nation. Now, again, God did not tell this to Sarah, he said it to Abraham. So can you imagine sitting at home and your husband comes home and says, "Guess what?" And so the sarcasm begins, everyone. "Oh, sure, I'd love to go to this native land I've never seen before because this voice told you to do that. Oh, yeah, we're totally going to become a great nation. I'd love to leave my father and mother and all my friends. That sounds wonderful. Oh, you want to take our punk nephew Lot? Yeah, let's go. Let's take him too. That sounds great." And then after this, a famine hits the land, which, Sarah's totally sitting there thinking, "Oh, yeah, I had no idea this land would get a famine because, we've lived here our whole life. Oh, wait, no, we haven't. We've never lived here before." So they go to Egypt, and Abram says, I'm afraid that the Egyptians, because you're so beautiful, the Egyptians want to marry you. In order to marry you, they'll kill me. So, Sarah, I want you to tell everyone that you're my sister." "Oh, yeah, sure, Abraham, what a great idea. This sounds like a wonderful idea. I'd love to marry a bunch of people who are ugly as sin and pretend that you, the man I love, is actually my brother. That sounds like a great idea. I don't see what could go wrong after all this." And so through all this, God blesses this situation, and then they get to leave, and they go to Abram, and then the next story in Genesis 13, Abram and Lot separate because their shepherds are having issues, because all their shepherds, their servants, they all start to fight between each other. And they're standing before all the land that God's about to give them, and they're looking out at this land. And I mean, can you imagine Sarah looking out at this land that she was told, that she was promised, that she was going to get? "Oh yeah, Abram, I see two plots of land. There's this one land that's got Chick-fil-A flowing all through it, and Michael Bublé concerts are free on Fridays. And oh, look, this other land over here's got 27 dead carcasses with a tumbleweed rolling on top of them. Oh wait, you want to let a punk nephew Lot choose which land he gets first? I wonder which. Oh, he picked Chick-fil-A. What a shocker! I guess we'll take the carcasses. That sounds so great. I love dead carcasses, and they make great stews from the dead bones. You know." This, and I mean, it goes on and on and on. If you skip over to chapter 18, she's living there, and these angels come in and tell Abraham and Sarah they're going to have a child. And Sarah is old, okay? She's like real old. I'm not talking like needs a walker old. I'm talking like needs a walker with tennis balls on it old. Okay? This wasn't like someone who, and you know, she still watched like Matlock and Murder, She Wrote, even though they're not even on TV anymore. And so this is when she's sitting at home, and can you imagine Abraham runs in and start making food for these strange men? Oh, sure, I'd love to make food for strange men. Oh, they say I'm going to have a baby even though I'm older than dirt. Yeah, that sounds wonderful. I'm going to totally buy into this. I am definitely going to have a son. And at this point, she laughs, and it's the one thing that Sarah oftentimes gets criticized for, but if you're in her shoes, you're thinking, how could this work out? We left our family, we left our friends to this land that then got a famine, had to go to Egypt, got kicked out of Egypt. It actually happened again with another group of people. They got kicked out from there as well because they made the exact same lie. Oh, sure, Abraham, it worked out so well the first time. Let's do it again. Yeah, great. So because of these different chains of events, she keeps looking over and over and wondering, when is this going to happen? Can you imagine in Genesis 22? Oh, Abraham, God told you to go and make a sacrifice involving our son and a knife and some wood, but there's no goat. I'm sure this will work out great. Go ahead, take my only son up on the hill. How could this possibly go wrong? I mean, can you imagine what this woman is going through over and over? So here's the two conclusions I came to. Either, one, Sarah was the most sarcastic woman ever. Or two, Sarah might have had greater faith than anyone in the Old Testament, in history. Because over and over and over again, each time she follows Abraham, she gets blessed. She laughs at what these angels say, yet she ends up with a son. She follows what Abraham tells her and says, yes, Abraham is indeed my brother. And these men whom she thought she was going to have to marry, they end up getting really, really sick. So she doesn't have to marry them. Abraham is now known today as the father of many nations. Well, guess who the mother is? She doesn't get a whole lot of shout outs, but I think Sarah fits that bill so, so well because she kept steering into it. Sometimes we fight and fight and fight and just get deeper into the predicaments we might be in, but Sarah says, yes, I will do what God is calling us to, because I know that in the end, it will lead to blessing. You know, when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, if you turn back to Mark 14, there actually was one little thing that Jesus said that could potentially lead us to believe that there was some resistance. But I think the resistance that Jesus gave is also the same resistance that we should be putting forth ourselves. And here's what it is. Jesus says in the Garden of Gethsemane, Chapter 14, verse 36, Abba, Father, he cried out, everything is possible for you. Please take this cup of suffering away from me. Yet I want your will to be done, not mine. Church, the best resistance against evil and against the forces of Satan is the request for God to intercede on our behalf. That is called prayer. That is the absolute best thing that will speak to God, that will speak to evil. But you see, Peter does it a little differently. If you look, starting in verse 66 of chapter 14, we get to where Peter begins his denial process, and he denies who Jesus is. Hey, you're a Galilean, you must know him. Oh, you were surely with him. And Jesus says, and Peter says, no, I do not know who this man is. I do not know who you're talking about. And if you look down at verse 71, he's done it twice. The third time he gets accused, and Peter says, a curse on me if I'm lying. I don't know this man you're talking about. And immediately the rooster crowed the second time. Suddenly Jesus' words flashed through Peter's mind. Before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times that you even know me. At this point, he breaks down and he weeps. Here's why I think he weeps. One, yes, he realizes he did indeed deny his Savior. I think that is one thing that really did happen. But I think the other reason that he is weeping so bitterly is because these things that Jesus has said over and over, I will be betrayed, I will be arrested, I will be killed at the hands of the people whom I have taught you are these wrongdoers, they're going to kill me. Peter wants so bad for this to not happen. But everything keeps happening the way that Jesus says, and it's at this point I think Peter realizes this is going to be an awful, awful evening and an awful, awful morning, and there is absolutely nothing I can do about it. And that's where so many of us end up in so many different ways. I know that because that's how my life was at so many different times. So I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, which we always called the belt buckle of the Bible Belt, the unofficial home of the churches of Christ. Like, we were the people who had it all figured out. This is the type of church I grew up at, where we had everything figured out. And I went to what was called I called it a suit church. And we, you know, all the men, they dressed up in suits. And let me first start off and say, there's nothing wrong with wearing a suit to church, okay? If you're wearing a suit right now, you're not a sinner. There's nothing wrong. You look fantastic, okay? However, I asked my mom when I was a kid, you know, Mom, why do people still dress like they're going to work in their suits when they go to church? And she told me, well, son, this is how people are putting on their best before God. You see, and this was a church where going forward at the invitation song where people stand and sing, and some churches call it an altar call, at these types of situations, at my church, that was unheard of, because no one would dare come forward and actually admit that they're a sinner. No one would admit that. But you see, when I was 12 years old, I started experiencing some things in my life that were very, very destructive habits. At the time, I didn't know that they were bad for me. I didn't know that they were things that could really hurt me. And then as time went on, I started to learn over the next 2-3 years, the way I figured was, I don't feel like I'm hurting right now, so I'm going to keep participating in it. And over the next 2-3 years, I continue, and then I finally learned that what I was struggling with was not something that was very life-giving. It was actually very life-taking. And I told myself, you know, hey, yeah, it probably is wrong, but you can stop whenever you want. If you've ever struggled with addiction, or you know someone who has struggled with addiction, then you might know that is like the banter slogan of any addict. I can stop whenever I want. And that was a little bit of my story, but I think deep down, the reason that I didn't want to reveal who I was is because I wanted to wear the suit that all the people, that all the men in my church were wearing. Because I knew some of the men in my church, they weren't the people whom God had called them to be, that they were making some decisions that were also very self-destructive in different ways. By the time I got to high school, I started being someone who wore a suit to church every Sunday. Again, that's not wrong. This is just how I perceived it when I was a teenager. And I kept hiding and acting like I had it all together. And I was a superstar in my youth group in my church. Whenever there was someone who couldn't lead worship, I was 16, they would call me. My junior and senior year, whenever the preachers, the youth ministers, whenever they couldn't make it to worship or they didn't feel like preaching, they would call me and ask me to do it. It wasn't good, but I still did it. And what I end up going into college at Oklahoma Christian is someone who felt like, I'm a superstar in the church, and I'm a future superstar in the church, but this entire time, I had never let go of my addiction, and I never told anyone. As a matter of fact, I worked so hard to even convince myself that I was not dealing with anything that could potentially be destructive. And all through college, I go battling this. And it wasn't until going into my senior year, I finally broke down, and I realized that it was time that I revealed who I really was. It was time that I opened up and told people that I had a problem, that I was struggling with something, that I was someone that God did not want. Because, yeah, I was the guy who had the answers. I was the worship leader and the preacher at 16 and 17, yet I was the fake. I was the person who told people when they were struggling with the same addiction I was dealing with that they were messed up, that they were sick, that they were twisted. And it wasn't until my senior year of college, going into that year, I admitted to a few people and they told me, you need some help. You have a problem. And I grew up in a family where I was told that the people who go to AA, NA, 12-step programs, they were the sick and twisted people. You're better than them, Casey. You're not like them. How wrong they were. And so I was told that I needed to go to one of these places. And so when I went out to college, I went to a ministry called Celebrate Recovery. And it was there that I was told by some of my friends, they said, when you get there, you will actually probably know some people, but we work to keep strict anonymity. So, you know, if you see someone you know, don't tell anybody. But you'll feel a lot more at home, which was great until I got there and did not know a single soul who was there and felt completely out of place. So there I am And I'd been told my whole life, these are the sick and twisted people whom you don't hang out with, whom you don't spend time with, because you're better than them. And I'm sitting there, and I raise my hand during the very first time, saying, I would like a chip, because I want to begin the road to recovery from my addiction. And it was at that point, the minister who was over the CR program there comes back. He puts a chip in my hand. He puts his arms around me. And it didn't sound like him when he said this. And I don't know how to explain this other than I'm convinced that God was speaking through that man. And he said something very simple, though. He said, I am so glad you're here. And so at that point, I did what any good Christian would do. I ran to the bathroom and cried my eyes out. I ran in there, I found the biggest stall, and I was dehydrated from how much I cried. I had to stop by the water fountain on the way back. I cried for 45 minutes straight. Tears coming out. My wife calls it the ugly cry. You know, you look really nasty the whole time. But there are two reasons that I cried. One was these people who I'd been told my whole life were like these sick, twisted people. I'm one of them. I'm one of those people. How could I have fallen this far? How could this have happened? Let me tell you, if you don't think you need Celebrate Recovery, or you don't think you need that type of openness and proclaiming the sin that's in your life, let me tell you, the difference between you and Celebrate Recovery people and 12-step people are the 12-step people are willing to admit that they have a problem. We're all broken people. The second reason that I was crying was actually tears of joy. And the reason for this, any addict in recovery will also tell you this, and studies also show 99% of people struggling with addiction who are in recovery are extremely thankful for what we call rock bottom. And I was thankful for it too. And the reason was this, I realized nothing could get any worse. In that point right there, it is at that point I could allow God to invite true, authentic healing into my life. Paul talks about something very, very similar in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, starting in verse 9. And this is actually one of the theme verses for Celebrate Recovery. Paul is struggling with something really, really badly. And he said, God, if it's possible, take this away. And God says, no, my grace is enough for you, Paul, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And Paul writes to the Corinthian church and said, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly in my weaknesses so that I may boast about Christ's power. For when I am weak, then I am strong. You see, we come here each morning and so many times, and this is what I was taught early on in life. I was taught, give God your best, your first fruits. And that's not wrong. Give God your best. But God is sitting here saying, I want more than that. And so we say, okay, God, here's my best. Here's my second best. God, here you go. And God says, no, no, no. I want more than that. And so we say, okay, God, I'm going to open up my arms. Here's my whole life. Take me. Take whatever and do whatever you'd like to do. And God says, I actually want more than that. So what do you want, God? And there's a Savior standing in front of you today saying, I want the trash in your life. I want the filth. Because that, the filth, is where I can look and say, this is where my power is going to flow through you. The good things, that's great. Give me the first fruits. I want that too. But give me the parts of you that are away from me, because I want all of you. And until I purify the filth, I cannot have you as fully mine. Maybe you're going through something that's really, really difficult in life. Maybe you're the one who caused that difficult thing to happen. Maybe it just happened to you and there's nothing you can do about it. Sometimes we fight and fight and fight, and there are times to fight. There are also times to acknowledge and realize, I am going through something so difficult and I need love and help and prayers. I need God and I need the church. You're going to have an opportunity to step forward or step back during that time. The elders and their wives are going to be standing in the back. I'll be standing down front. But perhaps you need to be liberated from what's putting chains on you. If we can help you in any way, please come forward or go to the back as we stand and sing this next song.